Salut отца и нашим дедам заветами всегда верны. Теперь ничто не остановит победный шаг. So, welcome back to the Security Perimeter Podcast. In this episode, we myth bust Putin's motivation for the war in Ukraine. A lot of folks have been talking about how NATO provoked, scared Vladimir Putin. And what I'm trying to do in this podcast is to myth bust that myth. And to do that, I invited my recently graduated undergraduate assistant Ines Gomez to help me out, kind of co-host the thing. Without further ado, here's a podcast myth busting Putin's motivation for the war. And and by the way, we end up concluding that this has nothing to do with NATO and has everything to do with Putin's desire to reestablish his empire, whatever that empire happens to be, the Soviet Empire, the Russian Empire, and also revenge. So the podcast is, I think, appropriately titled Empire and Revenge. I'm pretty pissed off. Like, I was telling my students in history today, I'm going to keep this, by the way. I was telling my students in history today that this is probably, in my 54 years, this is probably the most dangerous point that I can remember. And this includes the early 1980s, when things were really, really bad. Even the Cuban Missile Crisis wasn't this bad. This is a direct confrontation, something military confrontation. Oh, and so the reason we're doing this podcast is because we're gonna do a myth busting thing in us.
Okay.
So the myth busting thing is okay. Here, I'm gonna surprise you, Ines.
Okay.
It says this is not about neo Nazis in Ukraine.
Oh no!
I'm serious. It's not about neo Nazis. What were some of the other reasons that shithead mentioned neo-Nazis?
West expansion.
There was that one. That's the one I want to deal with here. But wasn't there a third reason?
Didn't you say there was like some sort of genocide hands and Nazi thing?
Right.
So he wanted to defend them.
That's true. Oh, and the thing that bugs me is like, I mean, nobody takes the neo-Nazi thing, but, well, actually, no, I do know at least one person that takes the neo-Nazi. We actually both know someone who takes the neo-Nazi. I wonder if that person still thinks that. The other one, of course, is, you know, this is NATO's fault, right? Because NATO expanded, and that's the one I want to deal with. So the argument is like this, and it's pretty straightforward. The argument is that, you know, NATO expanded, and it was about to expand, maybe, possibly, a next step of expansion, which would have included Ukraine. And Putin got all afraid, right? Putin got afraid. And he decided to, like, invade Ukraine for purely defensive reasons. To stop the expansion of NATO.
Yeah.
So this is what I want us to deal with. And please cut in at any point.
No, I was just gonna say, like, that's the official Russian rhetoric.
It is, but you'd be surprised how many people with educations. Actually, you know, buy into this.
Yeah, people outside.
Well, see, that's the other problem is that you got a lot of people who are talking about this who have no fucking idea what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Like today there was this, and that's not a thing that's driving me crazy. It's like dude or dudette, or I'm just going to use dude generically. Like, shut the fuck up. You've never studied this issue before. So just shut your fucking mouth. And I'll give you an example that I read to Chomsky.
Oh, but
did you? Yeah. I don't know if you saw that Chomsky. Chomsky says that
he commented on this. I'm not surprised.
You know what? Everybody's
everything.
What?
He comments on everything. Like, I'm not surprised he has actually an opinion about Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah, but the problem is that everybody's got an opinion, including their grandmother. And news outlets are actually, you know, inviting these people to comment, especially in this country where you really don't have too many people that understand NATO or understand European security, Cold War, post Cold War, World War II, and they're out there making comments that, dude, you have no freaking idea what the hell you're talking about. So Chomsky said that the West should negotiate, and then it was published in what's it called, The Beast or something like that. The
I don't know.
A new it's one of these new hipster like Innis type news outlets, you know, like online.
I don't know.
Not that it has anything to do with Innis, but we're just gonna call them Innis outlets.
Yeah, because they're hipster.
Because what?
Because they're hipster.
Yeah, and then The Beast says, and he's
Beast.
The Beast, and he says,
yeah,
he's right. Well, you don't even need to like be. First of all, this guy is not trained in international relations. He's certainly not trained in international security. He certainly has never thought about Vladimir Putin other than to say really positive shit about him over the last 10, 15 years, that poor Putin, right? And if there's one thing that we've learned is negotiation is not going to work with this guy. It's just not going to work. He's going to take it as a sign of weakness. And sure, maybe you can buy peace for 6 months, but 6 months down or a year down the line, well, you know, Latvia's next.
You're just giving him time to strike next somewhere else.
Sounds like Munich, right? But Chomsky makes this argument, and it's like, dude, did you actually ever study history, or do you know anything about this guy? Apparently not. So here's the, and I suppose that he would be someone who would be blaming NATO for this, but all right, so here's the myth busting. Let's start with the myth busting. So the argument is, you know, since the end of the Cold War, NATO has expanded, principally in Central and Eastern Europe. Of course, we know this, and there's like this myth that supposedly NATO promised that it wouldn't expand. Like, this never happened in this. NATO never promised that it wouldn't expand. The only thing that NATO promised was that if it did expand, and there were a lot of countries back in the early 1990s who were seriously thinking about this in Central and Eastern Europe, that NATO wouldn't deploy any forward forces in these new countries. So in other words, the discussion in the 90s was an implicit acceptance that possibly Poland might join at some point in the future, or some other Eastern Europe, Hungary might join, but that NATO, you know, Western NATO forces would not deploy in these countries. That's the only freaking promise that was on the table. So this promise that NATO made that it wouldn't accept, it's a ridiculous thing for NATO to do. It would never do anything like that. With all due respect, you know, I mean, even if they did make this promise in the early 1990s, it went along with this promise by Yeltsin and Gorbachev before him that the Soviets and the Russians would behave themselves, right? That they would be constructive members of the European security community.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, I think everything that's that NATO has done since it was created has been according to what it was created for. So there was a time and period where NATO could rely on what it had and not look for any other places to, like...
Yeah, and their mission was Europe, right?
But times have changed, you know, like the 90s. Like, it wasn't the same during the 70s, and it wasn't the same during the 90s, and it's not the same again. So it keeps changing, but what stays the same is NATO's spirit and NATO's objective in collective. Like, it's a different Russia.
It's a different Russia than... You're right, it's a different Russia than what... If this promise was made, it's a different... It was made to a different Russia. Or Russia made a promise that would behave itself, and the only thing that Russia has proven since Putin has come into power, starting with Chechnya, is that the Russians simply cannot behave themselves. You know, with all due respect to a potential promise and this idea that the Russians would behave themselves, because they did that, they did promise that they would be constructive members of the European security community. European security community. But after like 1993, 1994, 95 in Yugoslavia, when you get consistent vetoes being implemented by the Soviets in order to protect the Bosnian Serbs, who happened to be raping and pillaging and murdering, pretty much the same kind of human rights abuses that the Russians are committing right now. I guess they probably thought, oh, it's normal to go around raping women, you know? So, yeah, NATO breaks its promise. Once the other Eastern European countries see that what Russia's doing, which is not behaving themselves, well, yeah, I mean, are you surprised that in the context of the Bosnian wars or the Yugoslav wars, that all of a sudden there's like a shitload of Central European, Eastern European countries, I'd like to become a member, please?
No, of course it's logical, and we're seeing the same thing right now with Sweden wanting to join.
And Finland.
You know, they're saying, like, you know what, after all, I think it actually would be a pretty damn good idea to be in NATO at the moment. Because that's what happens in crisis moments, in wartime moments, in a region in particular. And Europe is a particularly treacherous region in terms of security.
So, right now, but it wasn't in 1990. Back to your point that what Europe looked like in 1990 when these discussions took place is not what Europe looks like now. And it's not what Europe looked like starting 2000.
Yeah.
I mean, the turning point is when Putin comes into power in 1999. I mean, that's actually a good point. I hadn't thought of it that way, Ennis. That if this promise was made, that it was made in a completely different context. For me, the context changes in 93, 94, 95. But you're kind of suggesting that this is like a Putin, post-Putin kind of thing that fundamentally changed. Because even after the Yugoslav wars, there were attempts to kind of get along and stuff like that, you know, and they did. I mean, under Yeltsin, and even under Putin, for the first decade or so, NATO considered Russia, up until strategic review that NATO did, which was in 2011,
mm-hmm.
they said that Russia's a partner in that document. 2011. You know, it's kind of in the context of Yugoslavia and post-Yugoslavia and the Soviet and the Russians not behaving themselves, especially when Putin comes in, starting with Chechnya.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. For me, like, the turning point is Chechnya. At least, I think from a security expert standpoint of view, like, that's when it changed. And what it What amuses me that I think for general opinion it should have changed in 2014.
Yeah.
For some reason it didn't, like not globally, like there are still, and even until this day, people that don't think of Russia as an intruder, an invader, and
You mean right now? Or
yeah, but
like,
even back then, like
well, yeah.
even with Crimea, like people still sort of appeased Putin,
Yep.
you know?
And even and there were people like me who were calling for, we weren't calling for war in 2014. What we were calling for was the kind of sanctions that they put in place right now and
Yeah.
punish Russia. Kick them out of the, they kicked Russia out of the G8, but go full Monty. I mean, just what they're doing now, they should have done in 2014. There was a whole bunch of us who were saying that it should be done because that was a scary kind of uh-oh moment for a lot of us. But you know what we were called in is we were called hawks. And then all of a sudden this invasion takes place and people are surprised about why it happened.
Yeah, no, but I get it because I started university in 2015, like right at the hype of that moment, and I
Yeah.
remember like really being interested in that topic and being rather dismissed.
Except for me.
Like, yeah, well, I didn't knew you back then. I didn't know you back then, but and I won't say names, but people were like, yeah, that's old news. Like, it's in the past. Like, it's more complex than that. It's not just Russia being an asshole, you know? But
Putin, let's be fair, it's Putin.
it is Putin, but
And but yeah, he's got domestic support for this, which is but they're brainwashed in this. It's like when Stalin dies, everybody starts crying and they're not getting news properly.
no,
But
people are
fair
pretty much
enough.
like harassed, like politically harassed by the Russian government. Like I keep
Yeah.
hearing stories of like elementary school teachers praying for peace in Ukraine and saying that maybe the Ukrainians are having a bad time and how can we help, and then they're being like charged with crimes against the Russian military,
Yeah,
so
what? Yeah,
years.
it's like a 15-year sentence. Up to 15 years. And it's there and it's very kind of Nazi-like because it's the students that are reporting the
Yeah,
teacher, sort of like what happened in the 30s in Germany.
so
Did you yeah.
exactly like I heard a few stories about that this morning, and I was shocked. Like exactly, I felt like I was listening to a story on Nazi Germany in the 30s, and it's Russia in 2022, you know? So.
It's the parallels are stunning between Putin and Hitler. The parallels are stunning. I actually think that Stalin behaved himself better than Putin because the last time Stalin did anything that was creepy and weird was like the 48 Berlin Christ, the airlift thing.
Yeah.
But then after that, I mean, yeah, there was the Korean War where he authorized the Kim to invade South Korea. But even during the whole, Korean War thing, both Truman and Stalin were like, we need to avoid direct confrontation because if it happens, then it's war. So even Stalin like behaved himself properly, comparatively speaking, to Putin.
But I think that relies on the fact that Stalin was actually like had a strategic mind, whereas Putin doesn't. Like Putin has an objective.
Yeah, and that's something I want, and that's something I suspect you can probably say more about because there's this idea that he's this great fucking strategist, which he isn't.
No, he's not.
He's like a judo kind of guy, right? He looks for
He
opportunities,
reacts. He
huh?
has an objective and he reacts, but his reaction is not always targeted at his objective in particular. He's just a very like nervy man in the sense that whenever he feels himself threatened, which is not scared, which is not the same, because people say that Putin gets scared, and I don't think he gets scared. He just feels threatened and he reacts, you know, like a porcupine. But that doesn't mean that he has like this grand plan strategy towards his goal. He just wants something, and I know you're gonna like get really into it in a little bit about what his plan.
He does have a strategy. The strategy is like he said it. He said like the worst geopolitical thing that happened in the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. Dude, like, what about World War II and Hitler? Maybe that was a bit more disastrous. But so if he thinks the collapse of the Soviet Union was the worst thing that happened, well, then obviously what his objective is to reconstruct the former empire, right?
Yeah, he has an objective, but he doesn't have a clear plan on how to do that, except from sending soldiers that are not prepared or aware of where they're being sent to.
Yeah.
Just to, like, get to that. But without a clear analysis of the situation. Like, we've discussed this. They thought it would take them 3 days to take Kiev.
Yeah.
And then two more to take Ukraine. And it's been months.
Yeah.
And they're still fighting. Like, they didn't give the Ukrainians enough credit for what they could do, and they didn't assess their own like army's capability.
We spoke about this, and I gotta admit, like all of us like defense people kind of assumed Ukraine was at more or less the same level as Russia, and that's why you had like the 3 to 5 to 1 week kind of expectation. What surprised us was the defense specialists. I'm trying to say here, what surprised us was that nobody really expected the Russians to do any good. I mean, the expectation was, look, it's overwhelming. It doesn't matter how incompetent they are, they're gonna overrun Ukraine because Ukraine is like so tiny. So that they were incompetent, this is something we've known since freaking Stalin. Well, since World War II. And they became even more so after the end of the Cold War because they, you know what? I can say with confidence that pretty much the officer corps, they're corrupt. I mean, their sole purpose of joining the army is to get involved in organized crime to make money. I've seen junior officers involved in prostitution in Europe. I mean, it's utter nonsense. So nobody really expected them to do well. It's just that we thought that because Ukraine is so tiny that it was going to be easy to overrun them. And actually, that didn't turn out. And the Ukrainians actually fought a lot better than everybody expected, because we thought the Ukrainians would fight like the Russians. What you mentioned, that the incompetence 18-year-old kind of kid who has no idea what the hell he's doing, right?
Well, that's it. Yeah.
But it's empire in us. He wants, I mean, the thing is, he wants the Russian / Soviet empire, because he, and you know what, even Russian people believe that that Russia is a great global power. And this is not a Soviet thing. This is not a Putin thing. This is like a Russian thing. We've seen it over and over again for the last 200-300 years. Ivan the Terrible, Peter the Great, Stalin, now Putin. Inevitably, what happens is they overextend themselves because the Russian economy is... Right now, it's actually smaller than the Mexican economy. I'm serious.
Yeah, but even before the sanctions, it wasn't...
No, it was the size of South Korea. I checked it. The Russian economy was the size of South Korea. They don't have the means to do this, and this is why they cycle through this, you know, up empire thing and then collapse. You know, Ivan the Terrible, then Peter the Great, then Stalin's empire in... If things go according to plan, what's going to happen is, yeah, you're going to get some remnants, something that they can call the Russian Empire. You guys are going to live through hell for the next 30 years, assuming you stay alive. And then Russia, surprise, surprise, is going to collapse again. And yes, we will have lost 30 years.
But if we stay on that line, it's not going to collapse with Putin. So that's really what's scary. Like, we still have a lot of Putin ahead of us. Because yeah. In each of those examples that you just named, they didn't live to see their empire die.
Mm.
It took generations.
For the Tsars
to collapse, and then for the USSR to collapse as well. So Putin's gonna probably die thinking of himself as a success. And then someone along the line will screw up his...
Well, he's gonna pick a successor that he can trust, that's gonna continue the project, and then that's going to continue until, let's say, three people or four people, and then it's just going to collapse, just like what Russia has done historically. But there's always a possibility that there might be a golpe, there might be like a coup d'etat. And I see that as the only way out of this right now, coup d'etat. I wanted to ask you, Ines, because you know about this a lot more than I do. You know this thing that people, well, you know, he was afraid and that kind of stuff. And you mentioned that Putin doesn't get afraid. I know you've done research on him. Like, I mean, what's the deal with this guy? Like you said, you mentioned the thing about strategy, but what's his personality like? I mean, you've read stuff that he said. What does he want?
He says he wants, well, it's different. One thing is what he says he wants, and the other thing is what he really wants. So he claims to be after this grand peace and coexistence with the West, which we all know is bullshit, because nothing he has ever done since he came to power has been according to that ultimate goal. But I think, and that's what's really powerful about him, is that he's really, he gets into people. Somehow, people believe him for some reason. I don't know what's about him. And
he's a charming motherfucker. Is that what you're saying?
Charming motherfucker. But this is something that many other motherfuckers have had in common. You know, like Hitler, for example.
Stalin.
Like, even if you don't know Russian or German, if you look at one of their speeches, you just like stare at them. You know, and that hypnotizing stuff that he has about him makes that version of what he wants believable. But from my point of view, after having been following this guy and his actions for years now, really, what he wants is, as you have already said, to go back to what Russia was during, like, the great Soviet Union, and, like, in a point in particular, because as you know, the USSR had its ups and its downs, and it was stronger in some moments than in others. So he keeps talking about this term, and I know you're familiar with, but I don't know if other people are, like this Novorossiya thing,
yeah,
in which he says, and I read in one of these speeches, he actually says that he doesn't know why, when the USSR broke down, they decided to give the Donbass to Ukraine and all this, like, eastern Ukraine back to Ukraine, because it used to be part of the USSR and it used to be part of Russia, and he doesn't understand why it happened. He does understand why it happened. He just says he doesn't.
Uh-huh.
This have been historically Ukrainian territories along with Sevastopol in Crimea. And this happens with the Baltic states. This happens with the Rus, this happens with Ukraine. And what he claims is that this should all be Russia. This is all Russia. And it was a mistake. Not only it was a terrible catastrophe that USSR came down in the 1990s, it was actually badly dealt with. Like, Russia came back losing from that. Not only did Russia lose what wasn't theirs rightfully, it lost things that he considered to be part of Russia, even though history tells us otherwise.
Plus also, you know, it was the Soviet Union that created these SSRs, these republics. So just because the Russians had an empire in the 17th century doesn't mean that you can own everything that the Russian Empire had in the 1800s, right?
But, like, I'm trying to make, like, a contrast. If, you know how Mexico lost half of its territory to the United States?
Yeah, you guys are still pissed off about that. Get over it, please.
Yeah, people are still pissed off about it. But it's like, if you say, like, California used to be Mexico, so California is really ours. Like, I mean, it's bullshit. But I get where it's coming from. But if you say Washington State should be part of Mexico because that was rightfully ours, then you're not even like looking at history from the right.
Or how about the Mexican Empire, which controlled much of Central America, and then they, you know, in the 1800s, was it that they said, "Screw you"?
Yeah, exactly.
Would be like Mexico saying that Nicaragua and El Salvador belongs to me.
Yeah, exactly. And that's pretty much what Putin is doing. He's not only claiming to have something that belonged to the USSR or Russia in the past.
It didn't belong to the USSR because they were independent. They were independent republics.
They were independent republics.
I'm doing air quotes. I'm doing air quotes independent, okay?
Yeah. And even in, like, Tsarist moments, it was understood to be part of the Ukrainian region or of the Belarusian region, you know?
Yeah, but can you imagine if the English made that argument? But then let's extend it and say, okay, well then if that's the case, then, well, you know, the British have a right to India.
Let alone India.
Much of Africa.
Go closer and stay, like, in the region, which is pretty much what Russia is doing. Like, they're claiming something that is a neighbor of them.
But you see, it wasn't Russia, it was empire.
Yes, right? You cannot make that difference.
But there is a difference, right? In the way that the British had their empire, and if you make that argument about the British now, you're going to get your ass kicked for it. This is the argument. Essentially, he's saying that Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, half of Poland, Ukraine are not, they're actually really Russian. It's not about it is about empire, but it's not about empire because based on what you just said, they were part of Russia, right? Completely ignoring the fact that Russia had an empire and that empire collapsed a few times. And, you know, when empires collapse, the remnants become independent states. So you gotta fucking live with it, dude.
Well,
he wants empire. That's the thing. It's like, I don't understand why people don't get this. This is not about Putin being afraid of NATO. This is about Putin wanting to reconstruct this freaking empire. And the reason I'm not guessing here, Innes, it's like he has said this repeatedly. When did he first say this junk?
Openly.
Yeah, like in one of the speeches that you said you looked at.
It has to have been after Crimea, for sure.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, like but Crimea, because for some reason Ukraine is like particularly important to him. So I remember this one sentence of like some reporter asked him like, how do you feel about Ukraine? Like, they actually asked this question, I think it was like 2016 or something. Yeah. Is Ukraine an independent state? You know, like a sovereign state? Do you consider it to be a country on its own? Something, right. We know that he doesn't consider. He has never, but he has openly said it since
2014? You mean after he invaded the country?
After he invaded.
I thought he invaded the country because, well, that's what everybody's saying. He invaded the country because he was afraid of NATO. Are you saying that that's not true, Innes?
No, that's
not. Well, what did he say after the Crimean invasion?
He said that.
Did he ever mention NATO?
No.
NATO was never mentioned.
No, he mentions the United States.
Yeah, well, you got to mention the U.S. because they're like the evil empire, right?
He said that there had been this coup planned from inside Kiev, to get Yanukovych out, and what he did was help this poor man. And then they moved him to Crimea because that's where the people really loved the Russians and could see how evil the West-orientated Ukrainians were in reality. And that's once he was there that he decided that it would be a good idea to make a referendum and to ask Crimea.
So NATO was never mentioned?
NATO was never mentioned.
Other than by like the token academic who thinks he knows what the hell he's talking about and says, oh, well, you know, they took Crimea because NATO was expanding. You're yeah. saying that's a lie?
He didn't say that.
He never said that, huh?
He picked up that argument a couple of years back.
Well, yeah.
Not immediately.
Okay, I'm feigning surprise here.
Yeah.
It's about empire. It's back to this thing about empire. He's just finding ways to justify it by saying, you know, well, you know, the breakup of the Soviet Union wasn't fair. These people are Russian. Everything just goes back to this idea about empire. You know, there's one thing I wanted to mention, though, and again, with these academics, and the timing of this invasion. And I remember in August, very clearly, I was saying, if the Americans leave Afghanistan, this is going to send a really bad signal to the Chinese and to the Russians. And it's not a freaking coincidence that this invasion took place literally a couple of months after, or this whole thing started to get planned a couple of months after the American withdrawal. And I remember fighting with a whole bunch of academics and telling him, this is going to be bad. And then reconnecting with these people who are not specialists in security and like in your face, you know, like,
yeah.
This is because of crime. This is because of Afghanistan. If anything, can I get to the NATO thing? Because yeah. If anything, the signals coming out of Brussels were that NATO is weak, not that NATO is too strong. 4 years of Donald Trump, plus Brexit, plus Euroscepticism, you put all that stuff together, and then you add a drop of Afghanistan. And Putin's like, okay, this is a good moment for me to do this. And mind you, what else is going to happen is I'm going to actually create more cleavage in NATO, and I might get a double bonus where NATO, you know, falls apart because they're almost ready to fall apart as it is.
But he was mistaken.
But the thing is, I mean, this goes back to this thing about, NATO was too aggressive. No, if anything, the signals coming out of Brussels were that NATO is weak and may actually be disappearing.
Yes.
And it took everyone by surprise, including like the NATO countries, how quickly they came together on this issue of the invasion of Ukraine. Like you said, it strengthened NATO. But that's not what he was picking up. He wasn't picking up a strong NATO.
No,
he was picking up a weak NATO.
And I still think he was picking a weak and NATO that was backing out. And I think that's what's happened since is that NATO's gotten stronger, but it hasn't gotten more aggressive. Like, they're still
no.
in the sidelines.
Yes and no, because you're getting a lot of... Now you're starting to get some heavy equipment being sent by the Canadians and the Slovaks and the Czechs
and
the Americans.
Not NATO as a whole, but there have been like this... I mean, it's incredible. It amazes me. This, troops, like international troops traveling to Ukraine, like on their own.
Yeah.
Vets and stuff. Particularly Americans, Canadians, Germans.
There's a whole bunch of Canadians in Mariupol in that steel factory that's like under siege right now as we speak, and which got the surrender thing, and the response was, you know, go fuck yourself, Putin.
Yeah, I think the other thing that that Putin assessed was that the European Union was weak because, and again, I don't think he was mistaken. There was, as you said, a lot of Euroscepticism. Particularly with Hungary and, well, after Brexit, of course.
Well, even Poland.
But they got together. Like,
yeah.
I think even the the European Union itself was surprised at how quickly they were like, we're doing this, yeah, okay, we're sanctioning, yeah, okay. Like, they check. Like, someone said that the European Union had made more agreements in a week than they had in 20 years.
Is that true? Would you know if that's a fact?
I don't know. It's
it wouldn't surprise me.
It was a reporter, like someone that's covering. I think it was Michael Barbaro, actually, but I don't know. As a New York Times reporter that said, like, the European Union had never done as much as
they've done
the first week of the invasion.
So sorry, I got to get back to the NATO thing because I'm obsessed. And I really want to make this myth bust, and it is turning out to be a real good myth busting thing. But Afghanistan is the reason why this happened. And I went back to these people and I said, you remember what I was saying in August about Afghanistan and what's going to do? What is going to happen? I said, listen, you know very well that if they had not left Afghanistan, this would not have happened. And there was, And you know what? You know what the response in the WhatsApp conversations was? No response. Because there was just no way to disagree with that point.
This is a semantics thing, but I don't think reason is the right word. Like, I agree with you.
The trigger. The triggering event.
A trigger, maybe a condition that allowed it.
Yeah, well, the reason is because he wants empire. The condition that the permissive condition was that, okay, I'm seeing a really weak NATO, plus they're getting their asses out of Afghanistan, plus they're fighting in the Pacific over submarines. There was a fight between the French and the Australians over submarine purchases. If anything, what the West looks like, NATO plus or whatever you want to call it, it looks bad. And I don't understand why people keep on insisting on this nonsense argument that it was because NATO was too strong and it was expanding. Do you know when is the last time that NATO expanded towards Russia? Was 2008? 2008. There has been subsequent expansion in the Balkans, right?
Yeah.
You know, Macedonia and well, one of the remnants of the Yugoslav Empire. Huh?
Yeah. I was trying to remember who was the last to join, and I think it was Macedonia.
Okay, so the last time NATO expanded, let's forget the whole issue of NATO looks like it's collapsing. Okay, and let's focus on the stupid thing, which is the size of NATO, which we shouldn't, but let's do it. Well, the last time NATO's size grew in a way that might potentially threaten Russia was in 2008. So why didn't he fucking say anything then? He didn't say anything then. His big problem that time was the color revolutions. Can you describe this to us a little bit, Innes? Because you know more about it than I do.
Yeah.
The threat that Putin identified wasn't NATO. It was
the color revolutions.
What are the color revolutions? Because you found this in a bunch of documents written by the Ministry of Defense of Russia?
Russia, yeah. Actually, 2014.
The latest one was 2014.
The color revolutions, they refer to this movements that took place in Europe and in the Middle East, Northern Africa and the Middle East around 2010, like 5 + 5 -
the Arab Spring, a.k.a.
Including the Arab Spring and the Orange Revolution of 2004 in Ukraine and the Purple Revolution, and that's why they're called the Color Revolutions.
Color Revolutions.
In which mainly it's about, they were about these countries trying to westernize themselves. In a way, like, step away, particularly from abusive governments, this repressive governments, mainly, and looking for, in particular, like, freedom of expression. That was the trigger of the spring, of the Arab Spring, and that was the trigger in 2004, and also corruption, and all these like flaws within governments, they were finding them. But for Russia, for Putin, was this sort of like meddling from the US and Western superpowers in these countries to turn them against Russia.
Well, I mean, that 2014 post-Crimean document that we looked at,
yeah,
goes even further and says that the freaking CIA caused the Arab Spring.
Yeah, they have like this sort of like a counter operation, but in the Middle East or in Ukraine. In the sense that the U.S. had spies and intel in these countries, like
and working with the opposition secretly, funding the opposition,
yes,
giving them
but
money.
Actually, what they are accusing the U.S. of doing something that they did themselves.
Yeah. In the U.S. election in 2016.
No, and in Ukraine, in the Donbass, Russia has been funding separatist movements and actually creating separatist movements within the Ukraine. Something they said the U.S. did. In Egypt and Belarus and Ukraine. And
you don't, I mean, other than the fact that, like, right after the Ukraine Crimea invasion, Putin comes out in this document and says the reason why we invaded Crimea was because they were trying to overthrow the legitimate government. If that's not evidence enough that that's what's going on in Putin's head in 2014, up until 2014. That has nothing to do with NATO, in other words. It has to do with this idea that... And it's because at the end of the day, he's afraid that they're going to do the same thing to him. Because
mm-hmm.
Clinton criticized him in 2012
mm-hmm.
very heavily about the election. And he was afraid of. He was afraid of like that he was going to be overthrown. But the other proof, apart from the fact that he said it right after 2014, is the Syrian intervention.
Mm-hmm.
No, they went there to stop a revolution. Well, a CIA-funded attempt to overthrow Assad. To keep Assad in power. But, you know, our friends are going to say, well, you know, it's more complicated. No, it's not. It's
yeah.
not. That's why he went there. He went there because he thought that the Arab Spring, funded by the CIA in one way or another, was going to spread to Syria, and enough is enough. And he turned Assad into a buddy, and NATO wasn't mentioned, wasn't it, after 2014? No. Even after the Crimean invasion, no NATO reference.
No, and it wasn't, like, the Syria, we're talking, that's 2013. But the Arab Spring starts before that. And the Ukrainian first revolution, like the 2004 revolution, started... Well, 10 years earlier.
Yeah.
And NATO was never mentioned.
Actually, the only time Putin ever did mention NATO as being a threat, you're probably too young to remember this, but in the 2000s, when the war on terror was going on, the United States wanted to deploy anti-ICBM missile system, like a defensive system against nuclear missiles in Central Eastern Europe, and the reason for that was Bush is really worried about Iran and these kind of new nuclear powers and stuff like that. But Putin said, and I'll accept this, that was a violation of a number of treaties that have been signed between the United States and the Soviet Union throughout the Cold War. But the point I'm trying to make is that the issue that was there for Russia with respect to NATO in the 2000s, up until 2012, up until after 2014, rather, is the missile system. It's not NATO expansion. It's the missile system. This is not a big secret. You can freaking look it up. He's never talking about NATO expansion. He's talking in the 2000s. He's talking about Bush's plan to deploy an anti-ballistic missile system in Central Eastern Europe. Which, if he would have stuck to that, that's actually a legitimate argument. Mm-hmm. But he didn't. He decided to drop the whole thing and go and now, like, you know, oh, it's NATO expansion. Oh, and by the way, Ennis, on the issue of NATO expansion, there was nobody was talking about Ukraine being a member of NATO. There was no way Ukraine was ever going to be a member of NATO because NATO does not allow countries that have territorial disputes become members. It makes sense. You're automatically at war if you let a country into the alliance that's like prepackaged with a territorial issue with another country. It means that you're at war with this other country. There was so when this whole NATO thing comes up in December, I could tell you from, you know, because I know this, that NATO's like, what the fuck is Putin talking about? Because it took everybody by surprise that he was making the argument about NATO expansion. Is like, are you so stupid that you don't know NATO can't and won't expand? But under these circumstances, he's making up shit as he goes along. That's the thing.
But I remember in Mexican news outlets, like, listening to that analysis and saying, well, maybe now, like, they actually do have a reason to allow Ukraine into NATO, which is, like, the exact opposite, you know? But this was...
Ain't gonna happen.
Like, I know, but it was a generalized belief that because Russia was threatening Ukraine as badly as it was, that NATO would say, okay, yeah, I'll protect you, which only shows how little...
Look, this is bias, okay? This is not analysis, this is bias. You're making a fundamental assumption that the problem has to be the result of the behavior of the West. There's no other possible option. And this is what you're getting in the media, in Mexico in particular, from people who have no idea what the hell they're talking about. But then it's not only in Mexico. It's all over the, you know, Chomsky. Wow, he's a moron. But I'm using him as an example. They're automatic. Okay, well, it can't be Russia that's to blame, right? It's got to be the West because the Americans are just fucking evil, and NATO's like evil. Why is NATO? Because it is. What do you mean? Give me evidence that it's evil. Well, it's NATO. It's like a circular argument.
Yeah.
And that's what they rely on when they make these kinds of comments. The other thing is that everybody's an expert now. 6 months ago, they were experts on COVID. A year ago, they were experts on, you know, Nicaraguan elections. 2 years ago, they were experts on Venezuela and oil. It's the famous word that we use here, todólogos, no, like experts on everything kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I'm going to say it again. I'm going to do it one by one. All right. NATO, the last time NATO expanded was 2008. Check. The issue that Putin had with NATO for the entire decade of the 2000s was the missile system. Check. If anything, NATO, the signals coming out of Brussels was that NATO was collapsing. Check. And the permissive condition that told Putin, you know what, this is a good time to do this, was Afghanistan. Check. That's it. This is what happened.
We have been discussing this underlying Putin necessity of becoming an empire.
Empire, but it's empire, and it's also revenge.
Yeah.
It's revenge for what happened at the end of the Cold War when the Soviet Union collapsed, and his in his mind how the West took advantage of this when in fact George Bush as president did everything to like make it as smooth as possible, and it's amazing how smooth the transition from the Cold War to the post-Cold War was. All of that has to do with George Bush, Papa, the father, the smart one.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I gotta admit, Gorbachev and to some extent Yeltsin. But it's revenge. Also, it's like we gotta get even for what they did to us. But what did they do? Your freaking empire collapsed because the economy was sick. It's that nothing to do with the West. But he still blames the West. You know, this thing about the greatest geopolitical disaster that ever happened in this, you know who's to blame for that, right? It's not the Russians. It's not Soviet economic policy. It's the Americans. And it's NATO. And you know what? People eat that stuff up because there's, like I said, a bias to automatically blame the West for anything that happens that's bad.
Yep.
Talk to me about some of the stuff this guy has said, because like I really want this to come out, this idea that NATO really doesn't come into the picture until, honestly, I know you know this better than I did because you checked this up, around 2015, 2016 is when NATO starts coming into the lexicography of Putin?
16.
You heard it there, folks. Not 2008, the last time NATO expanded, but 2016.
And not 2014, which was the first time that Russia actually took action against Ukraine directly.
Do you know what the funny thing is? Like, you speak to some of these so-called experts back in 2014, and you ask them, why is this happening? They're going to say, because of NATO expansion, which is bizarre, because not even Putin was saying NATO expansion in 2014. So, like, it's the horse's mouth is not saying NATO, but everybody else is saying NATO. Putin's saying empire, revenge, culture, these are our people, the breakup of the Soviet Union was unfair, blah, blah, blah. Everything you can possibly think of was in there except NATO. Am I right?
I have to appeal to Putin's charm. And the way he places it, and the way he, like, I was reading, and I actually, like, highlighted a few of his comments in this press conference.
Oh, please share.
Like, this one impressed me. It says, if Ukraine wants to keep its territorial integrity, and that is something that we also want, they need to understand that there is no sense in holding on to some village or other.
What the hell does that even mean?
Like, they can keep something, but
is this
to keep that village in particular?
Is this pre 2014 or post 2014?
Post. Same kind. Like, what? This is what I keep telling you. He looks at history badly. Like, he makes analysis and he makes like little nips and tucks in history in order to prove his point.
Please give us some tidbits.
So he goes even to like 1922. Okay, he goes back to a treaty of 1922.
That's when the Ukrainian Polish Soviet war took place.
Exactly. And he says, perhaps you're not aware of this, that in 1922, part of the Novorossiya had always been Russia. This was because there was essentially a single region with its center in Novorossiysk. This land included Kharkov, Lugansk, Donetsk, Kherson, and the Odessa region.
When did he say this?
This is 2015.
Okay.
So he says, like, in 1921-22, when the Soviet Union was formed, this territory was transformed from Russia to Ukraine. The communists had a simple logic. Their goal was to increase the share of proletariat in Ukraine so as to ensure that they had more support in various political processes.
Okay.
Yeah, so he says, like, they did this for, like, they needed it for the Soviet Union to survive, but this was actually Russian, and it's always been Russian. And he misinterprets his. Okay, this. So here he's talking about Crimea. Okay, so this was right after the invasion of Crimea, and he said that the idea to move the Crimean region to Ukraine, along with Sevastopol, despite the fact that it was a federal city, this was the personal initiative of Nikita Khrushchev. What stood behind this decision was a desire to win the support of the Ukrainian political establishment.
Yeah, so what?
Is it like he's just saying, like, we did that for political reasons?
Yeah.
But yeah, historically and culturally, Ukraine is, so we are meant to have it back. And not all of it, like, and that's the first
empire
centers that I told you, like,
empire.
They keep some of their integrity, of their territorial integrity. We have no problem with that, but there are, like, some things that, come on.
Empire.
It's ours.
It's empire.
It's been ours all the time. We have been deciding, we've been calling the shots on Donetsk since 1922.
Hey, who fought the Crimean War, right? It was the Russians. There you go. Did he mention the Crimean? Well, the first Crimean War. You know, I'm going back to the 1800s.
Yeah.
Does he go back then?
No, he doesn't. He stays in the creation of the Soviet Union. We never changed any of our priorities, aka establishing the Russia that was truly Russia. And well, not
is he talking about Russia under him, or is he talking about Russia like historically?
No, Russia under him. Like, okay. They have this this priority of turning Russia back into what it's supposed to be and not what the political necessities of first creating the Soviet Union and then dismantling the Soviet Union arose. So is it like we never change any of our priorities, even under the pressure of unfriendly actions.
Revenge.
On the part of Western partners.
Oh, okay.
Who are led very obviously by the United States.
Okay.
We did not even change our positions under their sanctions. So I don't know if...
Is this post-2014?
Yes, this is post-2014. So that's what I'm telling you. Whenever he mentions the West, he mentions the United States.
Yeah.
But he doesn't mention NATO. He sticks to the U.S. and he sticks to this notion of Russia calling the shots on territories that used to be part of the USSR and before that of the empire.
Okay.
But because they are there to call the shots on.
Right. And what's happening is that, okay, let's say it. Let's say the Western countries are giving him a hard time in his attempts to try to reconstruct his empire.
Exactly.
That's like, what that quote says.
What he's saying, and as absurd as it sounds, he's saying, we gave them independence, so it's ours to take back.
Oh, well, there you go. That, you know what? I accept that completely. That makes total sense to me. So that's the reason for the war. What is noteworthy in this is that of all the things that you said, you don't seem to mention NATO anywhere.
No, because that rhetoric came afterwards.
When did he start talking about NATO?
I think it's a Trump thing.
Ah. Okay, explain.
I think it comes along with Trump talking badly.
Saying NATO is useless.
NATO. Yeah. So I think Trump discredited NATO in his campaign, and then, of course, later on in his presidency, and we all know of the ties between Trump winning and
us.
Yeah, no, but the other thing that I think is interesting is that the first time that Putin starts talking about this Western threat,
yeah,
is after that 2014 Ukrainian Revolution, right? And that was all about the European Union. That was Ukraine joining the European Union. That's what started the whole thing. And actually, like a couple of weeks into the invasion, a few months ago, the European Union said, "Okay, we'll bring Ukraine into the European Union. Like, we'll accept it." And Putin didn't make a fuss about that. Like, it just swooped right past. But that hasn't made the noise that you would expect from someone that's claiming the West is taking over.
But the, you know, the thing is,
he's obsessed with NATO.
Is he obsessed with NATO, or did he just conveniently like invent it in the last 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, I think he invented it, but he obsessively committed to his invention.
Because, like I said before, Ukraine was not going to join NATO. There was no way Ukraine was going to join NATO. So the whole logic of NATO makes no sense.
Yeah.
It makes absolutely no sense. Yeah, and the problem is Putin starts talking about NATO, and then you got the talking heads all over the planet saying, "Oh yeah, it's NATO." You know what they're doing in this? They're buying into Putin's propaganda. I mean, directly.
Yeah.
You're basically buying in, Chomsky, if you're listening to this, which I doubt you are. You're basically buying into Putin's propaganda. A guy that has demonstrated the ruthlessness of Stalin and the unpredictability of Khrushchev.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a murderer, for Christ's sake. He's a murderer. And you're giving him the benefit of the doubt that when he says that it's NATO, well, then maybe it's NATO? Really? I remember, this is a guy that like poisons his opponents and kills them. This is a guy that probably, by the way, to justify the invasion of the second war in Chechnya, the reason why Putin went in was because there was a terrorist attack in Moscow, a number of buildings were hit, and automatically, this is when Putin's prime minister, not president yet.
Mm-hmm.
And Putin comes out and says, "This were the Chechen terrorists," and he used that as a justification to go to war in the second Chechen war, where he like literally flattened the entire region.
Like intel that says that actually was Russia itself.
Exactly. That it was the FSB, that it was the Russian Secret Service. Would that surprise you? I mean, they murder opponents. Why wouldn't they murder their own people in Moscow to justify an invasion of Chechnya? It's like, how could you possibly... I mean, the evidence supports, honestly, our point of view, that this was like a faked thing. This is very much so in the style of Putin to do something like this. Why would anybody doubt this?
Yeah.
You are talking about someone who's ruthless, murderer, absolutely no moral scruples whatsoever, raping, pillaging, murdering civilians left and right in Ukraine, left and right in Syria, left and right in Chechnya. But he's the victim here? It's NATO's fault, Ines? I just don't understand why people continue to buy this garbage. They're buying Putin's freaking propaganda. And I love asking this question, and I always get the same answer, which is, let me ask you something. Do you think it's possible that Putin, he himself, pulled the trigger and killed someone at some point in his life, where he put a gun in the back of the head of some whatever?
Sure.
Let's say when he was in the KGB. It's not unthinkable, is it?
No, of course not.
And people always respond, yeah. So, all right. So you agree that this guy's a murderer. So this guy who's like So this guy that you will accept the possibility that he may put a gun up against somebody's head and pull the trigger is the same guy who's afraid of NATO expansion? Give me a fucking break. That makes no sense. He's ruthless. There was this art, you know, one of the biggest reasons for why the whole NATO thing became a big issue was because Mearsheimer, right? Mearsheimer wrote this article where he said that it was all about balancing, right? That what the Russians were doing, what Putin was doing, was trying to balance the West, NATO. And that's where you got academic backing from someone who is known for being a specialist on security issues, who all of a sudden makes this argument and gives it some kind of academic credential called realism and structural realism, and makes the argument that it's about balance of power, and therefore NATO's to blame because it upset the balance of power, and it's completely reasonable that the Russians would react this way. Well, there's a real big problem with this guy's argument in this paper. Number one, he's assuming that, and I get a little academic here, there's two types of realism. There's defensive realism and there's offensive realism. He's assuming automatically that it's about defensive realism. You know, that defensive realism is about you feel threatened and you try to reestablish the balance of power, hence defensive.
Mm-hmm.
But he completely ignores the fact that there's this other type of realism, which is called offensive, where you try to upset the balance of power. Aprovechar, you know, take advantage of a situation, which I don't know why Mearsheimer would focus only on the defensive when the offensive realism is a perfectly reasonable explanation as well, that he's taking advantage. And the other thing is that realism and structural realism takes no account whatsoever of the personality of leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And based on what you've been saying, and based on what the world knows about this guy, you're going to tell me it doesn't make a difference that Putin's in power? That this would have happened no matter if Yeltsin was in power, this would have happened? Or if Gorbachev? Personality does matter. And Mearsheimer just simply refuses to acknowledge that personality actually does matter. And it maybe matters a lot in this particular case. Empire and revenge, right?
Mm-hmm.
Empire and revenge.
Empire and revenge.
That's what this is about.
Okay.
no more.